next at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry. 90.1
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. At my website, thinkwingradio.com, I link to all the articles I read and cite, as well as other relevant sources. We're having runoff elections resulting from the May 3rd contests. Early voting centers are open through Tuesday, June 3rd. Hours are Sunday from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. and Monday and Tuesday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. On Election Day, Saturday 7th, voting centers will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. If you are in line by 7 p.m. on any voting day, you cannot be turned away. The following entities have contracted with Harris County to host their contests. Check your sample ballot to see if you fall within the boundaries of any of these four entities. City of Pasadena Council Member District A, City of Pasadena Council Member District B, City of Pasadena Council Member District G, and the San Jacinto Community College District. You can visit the What's on My Ballot page at harrisvotes.com and enter your name or address to see all the contests and candidates you're eligible to vote on. I have provided the link in this blog post. You can bring handwritten notes or printed sample ballots to the voting booth. Just be sure to take them with you when you leave. The deadline to apply for a mail ballot was May 27th, so that's passed. For election and ballot information outside Harris County, go to your county's elections office. I have some of those at the bottom of this show post. Let me know if any need updating. For election information anywhere in Texas, you can go to votetexas.gov. Facebook user John Becker put out a very useful post regarding Harvard's free remote courses, with particular emphasis on courses on government and civics. With minor edits for clarity, I'll read that to you. It's entitled, Here is the Official Harvard University Website. The website is www.harvard.edu. There is a link to the free classes, which is in the web post, but it's a little long to read. And there is also a phone number if you'd like to call and speak to someone at Harvard, and that is 617-495-1000, also in the blog post. I understand that the current catalog of free courses at Harvard is being extensively expanded, so you'll want to check their website from time to time to see which new courses are being added if you find that the current free Harvard courses being offered don't meet your current academic needs. There is a link to the free government courses. Again, too long to read, but it is in the blog post. There are paid courses in there too, but the ones I'm talking about here, meaning John, are there on the first page. Among the courses, there's American Government Constitutional Foundations, and there are also free social sciences courses. For those with a serious desire to go to Harvard, here's your chance. If you just want to get clear and accurate information on American civics and social sciences, you can do a dive that's as deep or as shallow as you may wish. This has been a public service announcement. Our first story from CommunityImpact.com, aging neighborhoods, severe weather, drive home upgrades in the Woodlands. Solar roofs, home power generators, and fencing are among the issues most frequently brought to the Development Standards Committee, the DSC, by residents in the past year, according to a report presented to the Woodlands Township Board of Directors on May 28th. The DSC is responsible for overseeing the design standards for residential and commercial developments within the Woodlands, including new construction and renovations. DSC Chair Arthur Bredehoft said in the first quarter of 2025, the committee has handled 314 applications requesting variances to make home improvements. The majority of the applications revolved around three specific types of improvements: roof replacements, power generator installations, and new or heightened fences. DSC Chair Arthur Bredehoft said, quote, "As an older community, we're going through that rebuilding, redoing a lot of fences. Generators and roofs are a constant upgrade in the community, and also there's damage to roofs from storms. Roofs need to be replaced," unquote. Bredehoft said new rules are being used to help speed the process for a resident to apply for a variance to design standards. One such rule will ensure township design standards supersede neighborhood-specific design criteria. Bredehoft said, quote, "Sometimes neighborhood criteria can have a rule about a type of roof or a color of a roof, and the overall standards of the Woodlands can permit that color. The second part of that process would be to update the neighborhood criteria so the neighborhood criteria matches the overall standards of the Woodlands," unquote. Bredehoft said the DSC board is now also considering additional steps, including changing short-term rental regulations to provide stricter rules. "So far, short-term rentals, or STRs, are on file with the township," Bredehoft said. "However, staff is now looking into third-party services and partnering with Airbnb to gain a more accurate count and collect the proper taxes." Bredehoft said, quote, "What we want to achieve in mapping is to determine the density of short-term rentals in some of our neighborhoods. I think we need to be sharing more information in different communities because this is a big concern of a lot of residents on a national basis," unquote. Township legal counsel Brett Strong said enforcement has become much easier over the last few years, and two STR permits have been revoked because they did not abide by township regulations. He said, quote, "In our community, people that run short-term rentals generally do a good job and run it the right way," unquote. Bredehoft said the Development Standards Committee is working to finalize new commercial standards by the end of July. However, he said they're awaiting the draft report and feedback from community developers before it can be voted on by the DSC. Bredehoft said the next area of improvement will be developing the township's generator standards for residential properties. Their use has increased due to the number of power outages and severe weather events in the Woodlands, he said. Quote, "We could also determine that maybe what we have is good, it's working well, and you may not have to make many changes, but we want to take a look at generators as this is in the top three number of applications that we deal with," Bredehoft said. Now, I felt that reading this story was useful for a couple of reasons, even if you're not in the Woodlands. First is to remind listeners that neighborhoods age. Structures age physically, as the story mentions. Homes and properties require periodic maintenance and renewal. With aging home infrastructure comes the need or desire for minor facelifts or major remodels. Changes in available technology can also impact the need to upgrade home infrastructure. The Woodlands DSC is trying to address this structural inevitability in a reasonable and foresighted way, which is commendable. It's worth remembering that neighborhoods also go through generational changes, just like people. In fact, they go through those changes because of people. Consider deconstructing the word neighborhood. It describes a community of neighbors, many of whom might have little or nothing in common except the geographical area in which they all live. Collectively, they give this area characteristics that none of them might intend individually, but which a stranger visiting that neighborhood might perceive as a character or a vibe. I found in my travels that this collective character even extends to cities. Some I take an instant liking to, and others I don't particularly care for. It's a first impressions thing. Neighborhoods also tend to give a sense of age cohort, and potential home buyers respond to this, whether consciously or unconsciously. Young families are concerned about things like local schools, neighbors who are in their range of ages, and if they have children that their neighbor kids might make suitable friends or playmates. Families also look for neighbors who might have similar concerns and with whom they might have personal and social commonalities. They'll look for neighborhoods having certain amenities that are suitable for families or young couples. As families age, the nature of their desires and concerns also evolve. until you get a neighborhood of empty nesters who are old enough for their kids to have moved out, but who are young enough to be active in their communities and have active social lives. Eventually, neighborhoods age to the point of having mainly retirees and folks who are aging in place. The neighborhood might even start to attract these people for the peace and quiet of a street or neighborhood where there are few young people and the peace and quiet characteristics of such areas. This is a critical time in the life cycle of a neighborhood. Over a decade or two, these streets and neighborhoods will either degrade and empty, becoming late-stage rentals or vacancies owned by estates or banks, or they'll start to attract young families and homeowners who want to renovate these old homes, and that starts the cycle anew. At this latter time, homeowners associations and city organizations will have a lot of control over which of these alternatives is the outcome. And I bet you thought I'd never circle back to the article, right? But I am. Houston and its smaller surrounding cities can learn a lot from the Woodlands in this case. Parts of the Woodlands are now aging communities, having started development about 50 years ago. Their Development Standards Committee is essentially acting as a sort of zoning entity, attempting to guide and rationalize the renewal of these older areas. Whether you call it zoning or urban renewal or gentrification or something else, neighborhood groups and governmental entities need to be aware of these community life cycles and make an effort to help communities to successfully renew themselves as they go through these inevitable generational life cycles. The problem is that doing this in an ongoing fashion requires a kind of long-term foresight that is unusual in governance, but being cognizant of the process and the need is a step in the right direction. Also, from CommunityImpact.com, a proposed ordinance could allow Houston to inspect apartments with dangerous housing conditions. Houston City Council at Large member Letitia Plummer proposed during a May 27th Proposition A committee meeting an ordinance that would strengthen the enforcement and inspection of apartments with unsafe environments. The proposed ordinance would create a high-risk apartment inspection program, which would require properties with 10 or more habitability citations within 12 months to register as a high-risk rental building. Habitability citations or complaints can range from electrical hazards and plumbing violations to structural failures and typically revolve around the living conditions of a property and whether it meets habitation standards in accordance with the city's code of ordinances. These properties would undergo mandatory inspections from the city's Apartment Standards Enforcement Committee, or ASEC, and face misdemeanor fines ranging from $250 to $2,000 per violation per day, and possible revocation of the owner's certificate of occupancy and civil action if violations persist. Plummer said, quote, "The purpose of this ordinance is straightforward but profound. It is to protect our residents from substandard and dangerous housing conditions. This is about shifting from a reactive stance to one of preventive care for communities," unquote. ASEC is a committee with members from multiple city departments such as police, fire, engineering, health, and super neighborhoods that was created to reduce the frequency and severity of dangerous living conditions. Plummer's chief of staff, Munira Banji, said the proposed ordinance gives Apartment Standards Enforcement Committee, ASEC, the ability to take properties off the high-risk rental listings if they deem the property has ceased their dangerous living conditions. Plummer said that habitability complaints in multifamily housing has remained frequent and that there is currently no cohesive way to address these persisting complaints. From 2016 to 2021, 311 service requests were constantly around the 350,000 to 400,000 range. However, requests skyrocketed to 450,000 in 2024, according to a presentation shown during the committee meeting. 311 is the non-emergency service line to help Houston residents with issues such as traffic fines, sewer concerns, neighborhood complaints, and pothole problems, according to the service's website. In 2024, over 2,400 311 service calls were made related to multifamily habitability violations, with District J receiving the most calls at 407. Lastly, the proposed ordinance includes a special provision for senior living facilities, requiring them to provide a common area with generator power and a refrigerated space for medication storage during extreme weather events, according to the presentation. Houston Apartment Association CEO Casey Morgan said while the proposed ordinance is well-intentioned and has merit, she believes property owners and landlords should have the time to ask questions and raise concerns. She said issues such as defining what owner means in the ordinance and who exactly gets fined, as well as apartment owner representation in the ASEC committee, are a few questions they hope to have answered. Morgan said, quote, "Sometimes owners are multiple LLCs and they may not even be located in the city of Houston. So if you're issuing a fine, who does the city fine in that situation? I'll note that's an excellent point and one good reason for this organization to be involved in discussions of this proposition. Continuing, Taylor Laredo, a community navigator at Texas Housers, a nonprofit that supports low-income Texans' efforts toward affordable homes, said the ordinance will be nothing short of a game changer as it will ensure Houston residents' homes are safe. Laredo said, quote, "In my work with renters on the ground, I've seen firsthand the impact on tenants' mental health and their physical well-being, living in conditions that are inhabitable. The answer is never as simple as just move or just call and report the conditions. Tenants living in properties with substandard conditions are often fearful of retaliation and eviction for reporting poor conditions," unquote. I'll note here that when we were looking for investment properties in 2014, there was one I'll never forget. It was currently inhabited. The lighting was dark, the fixtures looked inadequate, and the dishwasher not only didn't work, it had rancid, smelly water inside that would not drain. I felt it was a health hazard and advised the tenant to insist that it got fixed or replaced. If I'd known that 311 existed at that time, I would have advised them to call. I'll note that none of those reasons were why we ultimately weren't interested in this property. But continuing, the committee voted unanimously on the proposed ordinance. After the ordinance goes through legal reviews and potential changes, it is expected to appear on the City Council agenda June 18th for a vote. Just to note, I considered myself to be a fair and decent landlord, and tenants have told me during and after the fact that they agreed. When it was owner's responsibility, I never hesitated to make repairs on a prompt basis whenever health and habitability were involved. But I've seen enough properties in need of significant maintenance to know that's not always the case. So as pointed out in the story, and to paraphrase Ghostbusters, who are you going to fine? I might hold the property manager or management company responsible. After all, they are literally the party that is supposed to take care of those sorts of complaints. They are a central point of contact for the tenant, the owners, and the city, and owners are supposed to give them the power and resources to make those decisions and to take those actions when necessary. Thus, it should be the property managers who make sure they have the credit resources to act when necessary, and if the owner entity or entities don't give a property manager the resources, then those managers shouldn't take on the job. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. We excerpt some stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 90% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. There's more information on our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and you can look for me on Threads and Blue Sky at ThinkWing Radio. This next story was pointed out to me by my former co-host, Andrew Ferguson, who belongs to the Green Party. It's from the Austin American-Statesman called "Texas GOP is rigging the ballot against third parties and voters are losing." It's an opinion piece by Kenneth Fagans. He is the chair of the Collin County Libertarian Party and a representative on the executive committee for the Libertarian Council of Texas. In Texas, democracy isn't being strangled with fanfare, it's being smothered in silence. House Bill 4309 was a straightforward fix to a glaring injustice. Third parties like the Libertarians and Greens nominate their candidates through privately funded conventions, not taxpayer-funded primaries. Yet under current law, third-party candidates are still required to pay the same filing fees as major party candidates, fees that fund primaries they neither participate in nor are allowed to under the Texas Election Code. HB 4309 sought to restore fairness by redirecting a third-party candidate's filing fees back to their party to help support their nominating convention. It wouldn't have cost taxpayers a dime. It simply respected the different paths parties take to the ballot while preserving the financial accountability that filing fees are meant to ensure. The bill earned support from both Democrats and Republicans in committee, an encouraging sign of cross-partisan recognition that the current system is broken. But when it recently reached the House floor, everything changed. HB 4309 was quietly killed, 60 yeas to 78 nays, and one present not voting. There was no debate. No one spoke in opposition. No amendments were offered, just silence, and a coordinated effort to protect the political status quo. This wasn't a policy disagreement. It was a calculated effort to suppress competition. Since the current filing fee structure was enacted, third-party participation on Texas ballots has plummeted by more than 70%. Libertarians and Green Party members fielded a total of 29 candidates in Texas races last year, down from 101 in 2018. In some races, voters are left with a single candidate they can choose, a ballot dressed up as democracy but hollow underneath. Voter suppression doesn't always look like purges or poll tests. Sometimes it looks like silence, procedural maneuvers designed to eliminate challengers before the people ever get to vote. A few legislators showed courage, and many Democrats stood united in doing the right thing. HB 4309 was authored by Democratic Representatives John Busey III of Austin, Richard Pena Raymond of Laredo, and Hubert Vaux of Houston. The overwhelming majority of their colleagues supported it on the floor. Representative Mihaela Plessa, Democrat of Plano, deserves special recognition for her consistent support, both in committee and during the final vote. Representative Matt Shaheen, Republican of Plano, also deserves credit for backing the bill in committee and standing alone among Republicans in support of fair access. But their voices and the will of those who supported fairness were drowned out by a majority intent on protecting the political status quo. This fight isn't about ideology, it's about principle. It's about whether Texans get to choose from a full slate of candidates or just the ones the two ruling parties allow. As our state grows and diversifies, voters deserve more choices, not fewer. The Texas GOP may think they've preserved their dominance, but in doing so, they've revealed their fear. Fear of fair competition, fear of dissent, fear of voters having real choices. And fear isn't just a tell. It's an opportunity for those who refuse to back down. Some may celebrate this outcome as a victory, but we know better. We won't forget, we won't be silent, and we won't stop fighting. Not for parties, but for the voters they're trying to keep quiet. I think third parties should and do have a place in an open democracy, and in that respect, I agree with Libertarian Chair Fagans with some qualifications. First, unless and until the Electoral College is abolished, I am absolutely opposed to third-party candidates running for president. I'm also against third parties running in any election in which a plurality can elect an individual. Winning an election should require a clear majority. I'm defining a clear majority here as at least 50% plus one. I also don't love so-called nonpartisan elections that can both divide the vote in ways that do not represent a clear will of the voters and which can be impacted by various nefarious means such as straw candidates that are put on the ballot by one party or another to try to dilute the vote for a particular candidate or party. This is also true of so-called jungle primaries in which individuals are running as members of parties, but again, can result in runoffs between candidates who do not actually represent the will of the voters due to dilution of votes. My poster boy for this view is former Maine Governor Paul LePage, a very Trumpy-slash-libertarian person who was elected governor of Maine. He won his first election in 2010 with under 38% of a vote that was split three ways, and elected a second time in 2014 with about 48% of a vote that was split three ways. LePage was finally defeated again in 2022 by current Maine Governor Janet Mills, who won with almost 56% of the vote in a three-way race. This is going the long way around to say that in the absence of a parliamentary system, third parties have the potential to be highly disruptive in elections and can distort outcomes. While no system is perfect and political operatives will always be trying to game the system, I think that we are in general need of ranked choice voting. This allows people to vote for a third party if that is their first choice, but can then also choose a second, third, or fourth preference that also has a chance at winning. A ranked choice voting system avoids runoffs, has the potential of undercutting straw candidates, and may be a system that is both fair to small parties while also being able to better express the actual will of the voters. So to circle back around to the opinion piece by Libertarian Chair Fagans, I agree that we should not suppress third-party participation in elections, but my caveat is that it should come with other election reforms along the lines of what I've discussed. For your information, Paul LePage is now running for Maine's CD2, which is currently held by Democrat Jared Golden. Do wish luck to Maine's CD2 residents. Next, from TheGuardian.com, undocumented man accused of making threat to Trump's life may be victim of frame-up. An undocumented man who was accused by the Department of Homeland Security or DHS Secretary Kristi Noem last week of threatening to assassinate Donald Trump in a letter may have been framed by someone accused of previously attacking that man, according to news reports. Investigators are said to be looking into whether the letter was an attempt to get the man deported to prevent him from testifying against his alleged attacker. The extremely public accusation against the 54-year-old father of three, Ramon Morales Reyes, led to his arrest and detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. News reports from CNN, ABC, and the Associated Press detail Morales Reyes's case and how Noem's highly publicized accusation against him appears to have unraveled. Prior to Noem accusing Morales Reyes of threatening to kill the president, local investigators in Milwaukee were already reportedly investigating whether the letter was a setup. Morales Reyes was allegedly assaulted by a man in September 2023 who slashed him with a box cutter before stealing his bike. As the case prepared to go to trial, ICE this month received the letter threatening to assassinate Trump. The handwritten letter, which was completely written in English and signed with Morales Reyes's name, says, quote, "I will self-deport myself back to Mexico, but not before I use my 30-yard six to shoot your precious president." I think the writer actually meant a 30-aught-6, but continuing, and this will be made clearer. Morales Reyes was arrested and detained, but local investigators compared Morales Reyes's handwriting with the letter and found they did not match. Meanwhile, activists and attorneys began working on his case. Local Wisconsin immigrant advocates and attorneys with Morales Reyes's family said during a press release on Friday that Morales Reyes did not write the letter. Said Christine Newman Ortiz, the executive director of Voces de la Frontera, an immigrant advocacy organization, quote, "A family member called our organizers, letting us know that this was impossible, as her father had very little formal education and could not read or write in Spanish, let alone perfect English," unquote. Citing police documents it had obtained, CNN reported that Milwaukee officials on Monday began reviewing jailhouse calls from the individual accused of having assaulted Morales Reyes and discovered he discussed sending letters to ICE in order to frame his alleged victim. He reportedly wanted to have Morales Reyes deported to prevent him from testifying in the robbery trial. "He outta here," the person said in a phone call earlier in May, according to the CNN report, and described how Trump's return to office was increasing deportations. On Wednesday, Noem began sharing the accusation that Morales Reyes, along with his photo and an image of the letter, which were posted in the press release on the DHS website. The accusation quickly spread on social media and right-wing Trump-allied sites. Noem said, quote, "Thanks to our ICE officers, this illegal alien who threatened to assassinate President Trump is behind bars. I will continue to take all measures necessary to ensure the protection of President Trump," unquote. Local officials and the DHS told Associated Press that the case is still under investigation. After the 2023 assault, Morales Reyes applied for a U visa, a special visa provided to undocumented victims of crime that may lead to a pathway to legal residency. The process to obtain a U visa is lengthy and complicated. It's unclear whether Noem will issue a correction on the matter, if Morales Reyes will be able to testify against the alleged perpetrator, or how his U visa application process may be affected by him being placed in ICE detention. My opinion, sadly, even though he appeared on ICE's radar for totally nefarious reasons, I fear that Mr. Morales Reyes is still screwed. Once ICE gets its barbed hooks into someone, apparently even U.S. citizens, it can be almost impossible to extract them. Mr. Morales Reyes may be lucky if he isn't deported to South Sudan. Again, we are now living under a fascist regime that considers law and the U.S. Constitution to be hindrances and annoyances rather than frameworks for justice. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston at 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. This show now airs on Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airs Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. At Think Wing Radio, we scour the news for stuff you may not know, and we need your support to keep doing that. Please donate to KPFT. Call 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. Or go online to kpft.org and make your pledge of support to keep commercial-free community radio on the air by clicking the donate button. Then each time you turn on the radio, you can hear your dollars at work. When you donate to KPFT, your dollars pay for transmitter and equipment costs, progressive talk shows like Think Wing Radio, Politics Done Right, and other locally generated political talk shows, and KPFT's online streaming, as well as maintaining a wide variety of music programs. So KPFT depends on your financial support to keep bringing you Think Wing Radio. Consider becoming a monthly sustainer for $5, $10, or $20, or even $100 per month. The consistent cash flow from sustainers helps KPFT to better plan their budget. If you're not currently a KPFT sustainer, there's a new sustainer match. Every new sustainer pledge, whether small or large, will get a $50 match. So if you pledge $50 a month, that gets a one-time $50 match. If you pledge $25 a month, that also gets a one-time $50 match. Even if you pledge $5 per month, that still gets a one-time $50 match. Also, new sustainers are uniquely eligible to get a memory brick that will be installed at the entrance to our building at 4504 Caroline. For your $25 per month or $300 sustainer pledge, a 4x8 memory brick will be inscribed with your message or memory. For $50 per month or $600 sustainer pledge, you can have an 8x8 memory brick. Bricks will be installed near our front door, so your pledge of ongoing support and you or your loved one will be memorialized for as long as we operate out of that building. After you make your pledge, you'll be contacted to make sure your requested inscription is correct. If you have any questions, you can contact Robin at kpft.org. That's Robin spelled R-O-B-I-N. Whether you become a monthly sustainer or a one-time supporter, please contribute whatever you can and support Think Wing Radio. No amount is too large or too small. It's all tax deductible. Call 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1, or give online at kpft.org. So please consider pledging your KPFT contribution as a sustainer donation, and remember, you may also qualify for a lovely thank you gift. We very much appreciate it. From TheGuardian.com, U.S. immigration authorities collecting DNA information of children in a criminal database. U.S. immigration authorities are collecting and uploading the DNA information of migrants, including children, to a national criminal database, according to government documents released earlier this month. The database includes the DNA of people who were either arrested or convicted of a crime, which law enforcement uses when seeking to match DNA collected at a crime scene. However, most of the people whose DNA has been collected by Customs and Border Patrol, CBP, the agency that published the documents, were not listed as having been accused of any felonies. Regardless, CBP is now creating a detailed DNA profile on migrants that will permanently be searchable by law enforcement, which amounts to a massive expansion of genetic surveillance, one expert said. The DNA information is stored in a database managed by the FBI called the Combined DNA Index System, or CODIS, which is used across the country by local, state, and federal law enforcement to identify suspects of crimes using their DNA data. Wired first reported the practice and the existence of these documents and estimates there are more than 133,000 migrant teens and children whose DNA has been collected and uploaded to CODIS. One of them was 4 years old. Hilton Beckham, the Assistant Commissioner of Public Affairs at CBP, told Wired in a statement, quote, "In order to secure our borders, CBP is devoting every resource available to identify who is entering our country. We are not letting human smugglers, child sex traffickers, and other criminals enter American communities. Toward this end, CBP collects DNA samples for submission to the FBI's Combined DNA Index System from persons in CBP custody who are arrested on federal criminal charges and from aliens detained under CBP's authority who are subject to fingerprinting and not otherwise exempt from the collection equipment," unquote. Experts at Georgetown University and the Center on Privacy and Technology published a report last week called Raiding the Genome: How the United States Government is Abusing Its Immigration Powers to Amass DNA for Future Policing, that found that CBP was collecting the DNA of almost every migrant detained, regardless of how long they were detained. The agency has added more than 1.5 million DNA profiles to CODIS since 2020, a 5,000% increase in just 3 years, according to the report. It's, quote, "a massive expansion of genetic surveillance and an unjustified invasion of privacy," according to one of the authors of the report, Emerald Tsay. Tsay said in a statement, quote, "The program reinforces harmful narratives about immigrants and intensifies existing policing practices that target immigrant communities and communities of color, making us all less safe," unquote. The documents CBP published, which detail each individual whose DNA was swabbed, including their age and country of origin, where they were transferred to, and what they were charged with, date back to as early as 2020. The latest document published is from the first quarter of 2025. There are hundreds of thousands of entries of people whose DNA has been collected by CBP between 2020 and 2024. Of the more than 130,000 individuals who were children or teens, nearly 230 were children under the age of 13, and more than 30,000 were between 14 and 17 years old, according to Wired. CBP first launched the pilot program to begin collecting detainees' DNA data in 2020 in accordance with a Department of Justice rule that gave the agency 3 years to comply with a new requirement to collect genetic samples and upload it to CODIS. At the time, CBP wrote that it was collecting DNA data from non-U.S. citizens who had been detained between the ages of 14 and 79. The Department of Homeland Security and CBP policy generally states that children under 14 are not obliged to have their DNA information collected, though there is some discretion afforded to field officers. However, this pace of genetic data collection would not have been possible in a criminal legal context, according to the Center on Privacy and Technology and Georgetown Report. The report reads, quote, "Until 2020, almost all the DNA profiles in CODIS's offender database were added by state and local police and other criminal law enforcement agencies. In the criminal context, there are some limitations on when, how, and from whom criminal law enforcement agencies can take DNA, which make the process of amassing samples cumbersome and resource-intensive," unquote. The expansion was possible partly because there are fewer limitations on DNA collection within the context of immigration. The report reads, quote, "In the immigration context, the only limitation on data collection is that the person must be detained. But the meaning of the term detained in the immigration context is notoriously broad, vague, and ever-shifting," unquote. According to the CBP website, the agency sends the DNA data directly to the FBI and does not store or maintain the DNA data itself. That genetic information is stored by the FBI indefinitely, according to the report from the Center on Privacy and Technology and Georgetown. The report reads, quoting CBP's documents, quote, "How would it change your behavior to know that the government had a drop of your blood or saliva containing your entire genetic code, which will be kept indefinitely in a government-controlled refrigerator in a warehouse in Northern Virginia? Would you feel free to seek out the medical or reproductive care you need? To attend protests and voice dissent? To gather together with the people of your choosing," unquote. Now, assuming that there are no nefarious intentions with this DNA collection, it can beneficially serve to reunite children and young people with parents and relatives. But putting these DNA results in CODIS, a criminal database, is deeply problematic. And to assume the absence of nefarious intentions by our current federal regime and the trickle-down fascism that it promulgates in governments and institutions downstream is something I can no longer do in this country. In my opinion, if CBP takes DNA swabs for their records, those results should only be added to CODIS in the presence of criminal charges. Otherwise, there should be a separate database geared to finding relatives who may have been separated in the process of crossing the border and being apprehended by CBP. Further, there should be at least three caveats when taking non-criminal DNA swabs. 1. DNA should only be taken from individuals who are 21 or older. Those DNA swabs should either be taken by informed consent or in the case of criminal arrests. I'll note here that I last heard that crossing the border illegally is not a criminal offense. It's considered a civil offense, which should not mandate the taking of DNA swabs. 2. DNA swabs taken in non-criminal circumstances should go into a separate database for purposes such as finding relatives. 3. In the case of minors under 21, DNA should only be taken with informed consent and in the presence of a lawyer for that individual to make sure that they understand all the circumstances and reasons for the DNA swab and to make sure that their rights are protected. I believe that surrendering DNA is protected by the Fifth Amendment and usually requires a warrant. At least, that's what I've learned from TV lawyers. We are living in abnormal times. We should be constantly alert for governmental actions that would not normally be legal or acceptable, because there have been many since January 20th, 2025. And speaking of abnormal times, from TheGuardian.com, U.S. federal judges consider creating their own armed security force as threats mount. Federal judges are discussing a proposal that would shift the armed security personnel responsible for their safety away from the Department of Justice and under their own control as fears mount that the Trump administration is failing to protect them from a rising tide of hostility. The Wall Street Journal revealed on Sunday that the idea of creating their own armed security detail emerged at a meeting of about 50 federal judges 2 months ago. A security committee at the twice-yearly judicial conference, a policy-making body for federal judges, raised concerns about the increasing number of threats against judges following Trump's relentless criticism of court rulings against his policies. Under the current system, federal judges are protected by the U.S. Marshals Service, which is managed by the Justice Department. According to Wall Street Journal, those participating at the March conference expressed worries that Trump might instruct the marshals to withdraw security protection from a judge who ruled against him. Amid those anxieties, the idea surfaced that federal judges should form their own armed security force. That would involve bringing the U.S. Marshals Service under the direct control of the head of judiciary, Chief Justice John Roberts. At present, marshals fall under the remit of Pam Bondi, the U.S. Attorney General. Bondi was appointed by the president and is a Trump loyalist. She has made clear she will be guided by him, breaking a decades-long norm that kept the White House at arm's length from the DOJ to ensure law enforcement and prosecutorial independence. John Konauer, a federal judge in the Western District of Washington, told the Journal that he thought the transfer of the marshals out of Trump's and into judicial control was a wonderful idea. He added, quote, "There's never been any reason in the 43 years that I've been on the bench to worry that the Marshals Service would do whatever was appropriate until recent years," unquote. Konauer is one of a growing number of judges who have faced security threats in the wake of Trump's deluge of invective. In February, the judge issued an order blocking Trump's attempt to end birthright citizenship for children born on U.S. soil to parents lacking legal status in the country. The judge was then targeted by a swatting attack, where a fake alarm is called into police and a SWAT team sent out to the individual's home. Senior Democrats have demanded an investigation into a spate of dozens of pizza deliveries to homes of the federal judges. The actions are seen as intimidatory, as it shows judges that their private addresses are known. Federal judges have found themselves on the front lines of constitutional battles over Trump's executive orders over such contentious issues as birthright citizenship, mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, and the dismissal of tens of thousands of federal employees. So far, there have been 249 legal challenges to Trump administration actions, according to a Just Security tracker. Trump has used his social media platform Truth Social to lash out at named judges who have blocked his policies on grounds that they violate the U.S. Constitution or law. When Judge James Boasberg objected to the deportation of Venezuelans to El Salvador in the absence of due process, the president called him a radical left lunatic and said he should be impeached. Boasberg was first appointed to the federal bench by Republican George W. Bush. The White House provided the Journal with a statement from the Justice Department. It said that marshals would, quote, "continue to protect the safety and security of federal judges," unquote, and that any other suggestion was absurd. If Democrats ever have strong majorities in Congress and control of the White House, there are some significant changes that will be necessary in how the executive branch is shaped and how it is controlled by future presidents. On my May 11th show, I discussed my ideas about putting the Department of Justice under the judiciary branch and making the position of U.S. Attorney General a separately elected position, totally independent of the president and the executive branch. On that show, I mentioned that the DOJ was a creature created by Congress in 1870. That means that Congress can alter it any time it wants, so I'm going to expand a little on my thoughts. Currently, the Attorney General reports directly to the president. That could be changed so the USAG reports to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which is less than ideal because the Chief Justice is not elected and has a lifetime tenure. This may require that while the USAG might report to the Chief Justice for such things as legal consultations, the USAG, as a now elected officer of the court, would not be bound by the Chief Justice. This sort of realignment will require some serious consideration be given to new checks and balances of power, but I think it's a way to proceed. Also, inspired by President Andrew Jackson's alleged retort to Chief Justice John Marshall that John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it, it's time that the Department of Justice had its own teeth that are not dependent on a potentially corrupt executive with various conflicts of legal interest. This might mean not only putting the U.S. Marshals under the newly independent DOJ, but also institutions like the FBI, ICE, the CBP, and other organizations that are supposed to enforce the law under the president's ultimate authority. This might even include moving cabinet-level departments like Homeland Security, which is at its heart a law enforcement agency, under the new jurisdiction of an elected U.S. Attorney General under the auspices of the judiciary branch. This would be a major reorganization in the federal government that would need careful thought before being framed in any kind of legislation. But I think our times have shown that it is among the kinds of important reforms that will be required in a post-Trump U.S. government. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. Again, that number is 713-526-5738 extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I'm on Threads and Blue Sky at Think Wing Radio. In international news from Reuters, Trump envoy says Russian concern over a NATO enlargement is fair. U.S. President Donald Trump's envoy to Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, said Russia's concern over the eastward enlargement of NATO was fair, and the United States did not want to see Ukraine in the U.S.-led military alliance. Asked by U.S. network ABC News about a Reuters report that Russia wanted a written pledge over NATO not enlarging eastwards to include Ukraine and other former Soviet republics, Kellogg said, quote, "It's a fair concern," unquote. Kellogg told ABC late on Thursday, quote, "We've said that to us. Ukraine coming into NATO is not on the table, and we're not the only country that says that. You know, I could probably give you four other countries in NATO, and it takes 32 of the 32 to allow you to come into NATO. That's one of the issues that Russia will bring up. They're not just talking Ukraine, they're talking the country of Georgia, they're talking Moldova," Kellogg said, adding that a decision on U.S. views of NATO enlargement was for Trump to make. Kellogg said the sequencing of the peace talks would include an attempt to merge the two memorandums drafted by Ukraine and Russia into one single document with talks in Turkey on Monday. Kellogg said, quote, "When we get into Istanbul next week, we'll sit down and talk," unquote, adding that the national security advisors from Germany, France, and Britain would join discussions on the memorandum with the United States. Kellogg said Trump was frustrated with Russia because he had seen, quote, "a level of unreasonableness," unquote, from Russian President Vladimir Putin. He scolded Russia for striking Ukrainian cities and said he had told Ukraine to turn up to talks. A conservative estimate of dead and injured in the Ukraine war from both sides combined totals 1.2 million, Kellogg said. He told NBC, "That is a stunning number. This is war on an industrial scale," unquote. I think Kellogg is an idiot working for Trump, who is a bigger idiot. First, to even say that Putin's concern about expanding NATO is fair is to give something away prior to actual negotiations. But hey, this is the art of the deal. Second, how is Russia's concern over neighboring nations joining NATO fair? NATO membership is not fair to the nation of Georgia, which was invaded by Russia. NATO membership is not fair to Ukraine, which was invaded by Russia. And while Moldova was not actually invaded by Russia, Russia has supported a breakaway section of Moldova and even has a few troops there. Every nation invaded by Russia and any nation bordering Russia has a perfectly sensible and understandable reason to want to join NATO, because Russia has proven itself to be a highly dangerous, expansionist, militaristic, and neo-imperialist nation, even when it was the USSR, and that it will stop at nothing to realize its revanchist territorial ambitions under Putin, and this will probably be the case for the foreseeable future and possibly for generations. NATO is the closest that any nation can get to being immune from Russian invasion. So far, at least, that is demonstrably true. The story I'm going to read from DefenseNews.com is Dateline from The Hague, Netherlands. In the body of the story is a link to a previous Reuters story of May 14th, Deadline London. After I read this story, I'll have some comments. Chinese hold on solar power tech raises fresh sabotage fears in Europe. Hidden components in Chinese-made solar power equipment have caused alarm bells in Western capitals amid concerns over Beijing's ability to interfere with power grids. Europe may be particularly vulnerable, experts say, with most of its solar farms potentially at risk of remote shutdown. The revelation of undeclared remote access devices in American solar farms, first reported by Reuters earlier this month, came less than a month after a power outage that shut down electricity for millions throughout Spain, Portugal, Andorra, and parts of France, highlighting the possible fragility of even highly developed and integrated European power grids. According to unnamed sources cited by Reuters, the communication devices that were embedded in solar farm gear were not shown on schematics and customer service information of the product, suggesting they may have been deliberately concealed. The undisclosed devices were reportedly found during a routine disassembly of Chinese-made power inverters, which serve to connect solar farms to the electric grid, control the flow of power, and maintain the all-important grid frequency. While Iberian authorities have ruled out a cyber attack in the case of the Peninsula massive blackout, the finding has nonetheless instilled a new sense of urgency in European planning to make the continent's integrated electrical grid safe and resilient. Inverters are crucial in linking photovoltaic power plants, or PV power plants, which output DC electricity to the broader electricity network, which runs on AC. In 2023, 78% of all inverters installed in Europe came from Chinese vendors, with the overwhelming majority made by Huawei and Sungrow, according to DNV, a risk consultancy. The report was commissioned by Solar Power Europe, an industry advocacy group. Control over the inverters allows outsiders to simultaneously disconnect generating capacity from the grid, which can cause blackouts. It would also allow them to manipulate voltage and frequency settings to destabilize local grids and to override safety protections like anti-islanding systems. Both Huawei and Sungrow have documented links to the Chinese government and the country's ruling Communist Party. Under Chinese law, Huawei faces mandatory cooperation requirements with intelligence services. The 2017 National Intelligence Law declares that Chinese companies must support, assist, and cooperate with China's intelligence gathering authorities. The European Solar Manufacturing Council, an industry association, said Europe's energy sovereignty is at serious risk due to the unregulated and remote control capabilities of photovoltaic inverters from high-risk non-European manufacturers, most notably from China. This isn't purely hypothetical either. In November 2024, some solar inverters in the US, UK, and Pakistan were actually disabled remotely from China. Very little was publicly revealed about this incident and its consequences. Investigations later showed that the shutdown may have been the result of an industry dispute, according to Günter Born, a German tech and cybersecurity journalist. Following the decoupling of Europe's energy needs from cheap and readily available Russian gas after the invasion of Ukraine, energy sovereignty has become a new priority for capitals across the continent. Renewables have been front and center, building on existing momentum to combat climate change and residual skepticism of nuclear power for its perceived safety shortcomings and high cost. Christoph Podewils, the ESMC Secretary General, citing numbers by the DNV consultancy, said, quote, "Today, over 200 gigawatts of European PV capacity is already linked to inverters manufactured in China, the equivalent of more than 200 nuclear power plants. This means Europe has effectively surrendered remote control of a vast portion of its electricity infrastructure," unquote. The Iberian Peninsula blackout was triggered by a 2.2 gigawatt loss of electricity generation that occurred within seconds. Previously, DNV had estimated that a loss of 3 gigawatts of generating power could have serious ramifications for the European power grid. The DNV report identified over a dozen threat scenarios, most of which it considered high or critical risks, even after the full implementation of existing EU cybersecurity measures. In the first 3 months of 2025 alone, data from the energy think tank Ember shows that nearly 68 terawatt hours of electricity were produced by solar panels. It amounted to 8.2% of Europe's electricity production in March, despite the shorter days at that time of year. In the summer, around 15% of Europe's electricity may come from the sun, with some countries relying on it to make up over a quarter of their total energy mix during daytime. According to Solar Power Europe, the industry advocacy group, the installed PV capacity in Europe is expected to exceed 800 gigawatts by 2030. The shock of the Spanish power outage, even without it being caused by an attack, has jolted some in Europe into action. but consciousness surrounding a China vulnerability predates the grid collapse. Lithuania, on May 1st, implemented new legislation that requires photovoltaic projects above 100 kilowatts to use inverters that meet national safety standards. Existing projects must be retrofitted. This practically outlaws Chinese inverters in the country's power structure. Late last year, Estonia's spy chief Kaupo Rosen said that Chinese technology and critical infrastructure, particularly solar farms, could open up Europe to Chinese blackmail. Some European lawmakers are also taking note, with one member of the European Parliament submitting an inquiry on May 15th on the topic of solar inverters and the risk of Chinese influence. A 2022 directive called NIS2 provides the basis for joint cybersecurity defense measures of critical infrastructure. However, the directive primarily applies to very large projects, leaving smaller power generation projects vulnerable. This is particularly relevant to solar, which is not only produced in large farms, but also by countless dispersed smaller photovoltaic projects, such as those on rooftops and factory grounds. I'll be including a fair number of links in the scripted comments. You can check them out by going to today's story post at thinkwingradio.com. Tariffs applied with something like surgical precision have their uses. If I were to consider targeted tariffs to incentivize domestic production for reasons of both economic and security, electrical inverters would certainly be on the list, as well as Chinese-made solar panels, communications gear, device controls, and other electronic equipment. I'm no strategic genius, and yet I've been saying for literally decades that it was stupid to relegate ourselves to our current state of vulnerability. Regular listeners may recall that some months ago, unauthorized and unlisted backdoor communications devices were found in Chinese-made cargo cranes in U.S. ports. I discussed them last year on the September 19th and October 10th editions of this show. In 2022, there were numerous stories specifically about Huawei communications equipment that posed security risks in cell phone networks that were in proximity to defense grids and bases and with potential to disrupt our nuclear defense systems. Since 2017, certain Huawei products were designated as a security risk to the U.S. and its allies. In fact, the U.S. applied a fair amount of pressure to our NATO and other allies to prevent them from buying 5G network equipment from Huawei for this very reason. It's important to note again this sentence from the story. China's 2017 National Intelligence Law declares that Chinese companies must support, assist, and cooperate with China's intelligence gathering. So the threat discovered in solar power equipment, including batteries, is not new, should not be surprising, and should remind us that China has been playing a very long game against us and our allies. There's a saying with various questionable attributions, but which is applicable here. When it comes time to hang the capitalists, they will compete to sell us the rope. We've been cheerfully buying the metaphorical rope from China, so we won't even have to compete to sell it to them. By the way of a total digression, if you want to know more about that quote, I'm including a link to a comprehensive discussion of its possible attribution or the lack thereof. That's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, 90.1 HD2, Galveston, 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville, 91.9 HD2. We are Houston's community media. I hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and I look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
We have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? Not too late, we should be giving. Only with love can we climb. It's not too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. Closer to the shore, I know we'll be there by tomorrow, and we'll escape the darkness. We will.